know why it's my favorite place. The scallops are the best I've ever had, cooked just perfectly. A touch of butter and lemon, but not overplaying it, letting the seafood speak for itself. The fries are nicely seasoned, and the creamy garlic sauce accompanying them is enough to make me change religions. We top it all off with a second round of beer, but I'll stop there. Okay, I say, now that we've gotten a peek at the hunky owner of this place, I've dispensed my advice, and I've had some of the best seafood I've ever eaten. Now it's time to ruin my appetite. It will, she says. It definitely will. Chapter 50. Okay, here. Ricketts removes a piece of paper from her file folder. 8 victims over the last decade, all unsolved. I know about the ones last year, summer of 2011, I say. Zach and Melanie, Bonnie Stamos, my uncle. Let's start with the older ones, before I came here. Good, she says. That's what I did. Dee Dee Paris, I say, reading the first name. Last seen May 9th, 2007. The first two go together, says Ricketts. Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church, Yale sophomores. May 9th was when they left New Haven that summer. They lied to their friends and family about how they were spending their summer. They came here to the Hamptons. That was discovered later, through cell phone records, and then their car, which was ultimately found in Montauk after a lengthy search. She removes 2 photos from her file folder and hands them to me. Dee Dee is the blonde, Annie the brunette. Dee Dee's photograph is from a volleyball game. She's tall and athletic, with blonde hair cropped tight against her head. The photo of Annie is a school photo, probably from high school. A bright smile and warm eyes, her hair past her shoulders. Reddish brown. So they were killed in Montauk, I ask. Ricketts shrugs. Nobody knows. That's where their car was found. Their bodies were never found. Or, I should say, most of their bodies was never found. I look at the document she typed, organized and professional. Her finger, I say, reading her one-line summary for Dee Dee. Yeah, they found one of Dee Dee's fingers in the woods near Montauk, 2 years after they disappeared. We always assumed foul play, but didn't know it until somebody's dog found the finger. Then they got a DNA match. So they were killed in 2007, and a single finger was found in 2009. 2 years and nobody found it. Well, that's possible, sure, but... Tell me about the finger, I say. Was it decomposed? Was there anything distinctive about it? No and yes. She opens her folder again and shows me a photograph of the finger. Not decomposed much at all. Well preserved, with a ring on it. A class ring from Santa Monica High School, if I'm reading that right. Okay, I say, handing her back the photo. She slides it into her folder. So after that, we have the third one, Brittany Halstead, I say. July 2008. Prostitute, says Ricketts. She hands me another photo, a mugshot. Oh, she's young, not more than 18 or 19 in this photo. She is thin, blonde, attractive, but with a beat-up look about her that most working girls have. She used the name Barbie on the street, says Ricketts. Last seen alive getting on the back of a motorcycle outside a nightclub in Shirley. She told her friends she was going to be gone for the night. The whole night. Smart of him. Nobody would be expecting her back. It would give the offender some time before anyone would be looking for her. Last seen alive, I say. So they found her. They found Brittany. She hands me another photograph. A couple of miles down Sunrise Highway from where she was picked up on the motorcycle. She is lying face down in a bed of leaves, her head turned toward the camera, her eyes shut. She has the ghostly mannequin look of a corpse dead for at least a couple of days. A pool of blood surrounds the lower half of her body. This photo doesn't show it, says Ricketts. But he carved her up. He disemboweled her. The ME thought he used a corkscrew. Oh, God. A corkscrew? I say, as if there were a nice way of disemboweling someone. I look at the remainder of the sheet. So then in 2010, we have Sally Feister. And then we move up to 2011. to Melanie and Zach, Bonnie Stamos, and my uncle. That's interesting. Why's that interesting? I look at Ricketts, who is watching me carefully. She's a pup, looking to learn a thing or two, so I explain my thoughts. We don't know if this is the same offender, I say. But if it is, look at the timing. He kills in 2007, then in 2008 he kills again. Then he doesn't kill again until 2010 with Sally Feister. So, what does that mean? He didn't do anything in 2009. Well, he did do something in 2009, I correct. He planted Dee Dee Paris's finger for us to find. Clearly, he preserved that finger, or it would have been badly decomposed. And just in case we had trouble identifying it, he made sure her high school class ring was on it. He might as well have posted a sign saying, "Look, everyone, this is Dee Dee's finger." He wanted us to know, she says. Why? Ricketts sits quietly, her eyes moving around the room, her mental machinery fully in gear. He was struggling, I say. He didn't want to kill anybody else. But you know what else was bothering him? What? He wasn't getting any attention, I say. She draws back. Attention? You think he wants to get caught? Oh, no. This guy does not want to get caught. Quite the opposite. This guy gets off on the thrill of getting away with it, of doing something so terrible and walking away scot-free. I'm sure the stories about Annie and Dee Dee were all over the South Shore papers in 2007. Two Yale undergrads gone missing? It was probably huge news on the South Shore. And the murder of the prostitute in 2008? Well, not as big, but still a gruesome murder, right? So once again, he's getting attention. He's reminded of how powerful he is. Big, newsworthy crimes. Crimes that he committed. And he's reading about them in his bathrobe with a cup of coffee. But his conscience was bothering him, she says. Right, I point to her. So in 2009, he's struggling. He doesn't want to kill again, but he needs the adulation, the feeling of power. So what does he do? He reminds everyone of what he did in 2007. Exactly. He plants Dee Dee's finger with the class ring, and voila. There were probably a ton of stories all over again, this time assuming the Yale students are dead. How tragic, how horrible, how mystified the police are. And how powerful he is. How powerful and impressive he is. I sweep a hand. He gets the thrill of it without the bloodshed or the risk. That's fascinating, she says, leaning her head on one hand. How your mind works? I wave it off. I could be all wrong. Might not even be the same person. Her eyebrow rises slightly. Well, it makes sense to me. Especially when you see what he did to Sally Feister in 2010.
Book 4. The Hamptons, 2010. Chapter 51. He is cold. Though the sun beats down on him at this beach cafe, the temperature nearing 90 degrees. He has to piss, though he just went 20 minutes ago. His stomach churns like rusty grinding gears, though he's just eaten. He sees her through his sunglasses, basking in the white, bright sunlight, a bronzed, lithe body, the backpack over both shoulders, a white tank top and denim shorts, sunglasses perched atop her white blonde hair as she takes a photo of herself on her smartphone with the Atlantic Ocean in the background. He watched her. Watched her as she ate at this very cafe, vegetables and hummus, a glass of Chardonnay, and texted on her smartphone and told the waitress what she's doing this summer and got a recommendation for a good beach to crash on tonight. She and the server even talked music briefly. She likes the modern pop stuff, but prefers classical, cello music mostly. Of course, Yo-Yo Ma and Dupre, but also a newer crop, like Alyssa Weilerstein, whoever that is. He likes the name Alyssa. It would be cool to have a girlfriend named Alyssa. He wrote down everything she said. The beach where she will sleep, her musical preferences. And this too. Sally. She told the waitress her name was Sally. Not quite as exciting a name as Alyssa. He reaches for the check the waitress has left and notices the tremble in his hand. His fingernails chewed down to the point of bloodiness. He shouldn't chew his nails, he knows that. His mother would say it makes him look unrefined. But he's got lots of refinement. Is that a word? He'll look it up later. He feels the pressure building in his bladder, a dam on the verge of bursting. Sally is exiting the beach now, walking up onto the asphalt parking lot, her hands gripping the shoulder straps of the backpack. The muscles in her legs straining, well-defined. Her arms are hard, too. Long, thin slivers of muscle. But his favorite part is the backpack. It means she's passing through, not a native. A loner. No friend or spouse or lover expecting her home tonight. Holden is smart. Maybe not school smart, but he isn't dumb. And he knows his history well. A peasant, any peasant will do. And better still, a stranger. Whoever shall not be missed is welcome in my chamber. He walks over to his motorcycle and throws on his helmet but keeps the shield up. Climbs onto the bike. Looks over at Sally as she passes. Nods to her. Too nervous to speak, though. And probably best that he doesn't. His voice might shake. He's still a little nervous, a little rusty. He drives off, lets time pass, the sun disappearing in a burst of color to the west. He uses his secret entrance into Seven Ocean Drive, the one specially for him. The one he used when Annie and Dee Dee were staying there. The one he uses when he wants to sleep there himself, which he does from time to time. It's his house, after all, even if nobody else knows it. Once he's inside, down in the basement, he drops his fun bag and gets to work. He lays down the tarp, tests the chain's connection to the ceiling, locks and unlocks the handcuffs. Tonight he's going to feast on duck and pheasant, on grapes and cheese. And then he's going to find the girl named Sally and bring her back to the chamber. Chapter 52. Sally Feister stretches her legs in the cushy sand and rests her head against her soft pack, the water crashing to the shore only 10 yards away. She looks up into a purple sky and lets out a satisfied breath. This is just what she needed, this summer. After a soul-killing desk job for 2 years and a ridiculous decision to accept that marriage proposal, she was starting down a road from which she would not be able to turn aside. Oh, he was a nice enough guy, and he had a terrific smile, a good sense of humor, but he didn't ignite that pilot light inside her. Isn't life supposed to be exciting? Aren't you supposed to love, not merely tolerate your job? Aren't you supposed to commit to a man not because it's time, or because you want kids, or because he'd be a good provider, but because he makes your heart go pitter-pat? Of course, yes to all of that. It seems so obvious now. It didn't when she was stuck in that rut, like a hamster on a wheel. But once she opened her eyes and broke off the engagement, quit her shitty job and gathered up her savings for a year of travel, it revealed itself to her so clearly. She wants to explore. She wants to meet people and experience new things. She wants a man who's adventurous, non-judgmental, not materialistic. She wants a man who is patient and at ease with himself. She wants a man who transports her to a world she's never known. Or fuck it, she'll do without a man altogether. The decision to travel alone, deemed by her mother insane, by her envious friends awesome, was the best she could have made. She's only 9 weeks in thus far, traveling the beaches of Long Island this summer by foot before heading to the West Coast and then Europe. But she's learned so much about herself, about what she wants and needs and expects from life. And damn, all this walking has restored her triathlon physique from 2 years ago. She feels like herself again. She's reaching for her smartphone, because solitude has its limits, She still posts regularly on Facebook and texts with her friends, when she sees something out of the corner of her eye, a figure emerging from the ocean in a wetsuit, the glow of moonlight on him. She's a night swimmer too, but it's a bit chilly this evening, so she took a pass. The man trudges up the beach in her general direction, but then stops. For the first time, she notices that he's staked out a spot on the beach just like her, about 20 yards to her left. There aren't that many people sleeping on the beach tonight, but then again, she chose this remote beach for that very reason. A light comes on by the man's spot. A flashlight? No, a battery-charged lantern, and he seems to be settling in for the night. She watches him for a time and then returns her gaze to the sky. Sometimes she likes company and seeks it out, hangs out at bonfires, shares a bottle of wine or a joint. But other nights, like this, she prefers the quiet of her own company. It's her choice. That's the best part. It's her decision entirely. And then, faint at first and then her hearing adjusts to it, over the sound of rolling waves, music. The soft whine, the dramatic upward lilt to the impossibly high notes, so sweet and despairing. Cello music, she thinks. He's listening to cello music. Chapter 53. He can see why Sally likes this music. It's really good. It can be really loud and it can be really quiet, really fast and really slow. It can be violent, it can be chaotic, and it can be like a lullaby almost. It makes him feel happy and sad within the same song, except they don't call it a song, they call it a concerto. He already knew that. He knew they were called concertos before he looked up the cello stuff this afternoon. This music can do one other thing too, at least tonight. It can get Sally's attention up the beachways.
Excuse me?
He pretends to be startled at Sally's voice. It's actually not that hard to pretend, because he's nervous anyway, so it kind of works double like that.
Sorry to bother you. Is this Weilerstein?
Is the music too loud?
No, not at all.
Sorry.
No, I love this music. You're a fan?
Yeah, he shrugs. I don't know much about it, I just like it.
See, he planned this out. He knew that if he pretended like he knew all sorts of stuff about the cello, she'd ask him questions he couldn't answer. That's an example that he's maybe not so smart in school, but smart in planning stuff. She laughs.
That's all you need to know. People get so caught up in all the pretentious bullshit.
Yeah, it's just so...
He leans forward.
Like you feel happy and sad at the same time, kinda.
I totally know what you mean. It can be so emotional, right?
He can hardly see Sally's face as she stands over him, but he can smell her. Fruit. She smells like fruit.
I have wine, he says. If you...
Yeah, I mean, if that's cool.
Okay, yeah.
Still nervous, but that's okay, because it makes him seem harmless to her. She sits down next to him on the blanket he's laid out, next to the fun bag with the wine bottle sticking out. Through the speaker on his iPod, the cellist bursts out of a lull with a crisp flourish. Holden pours some wine into a plastic glass and hands it to Sally.
It's not fancy or anything, he says.
No, that's cool, whatever.
He hopes she doesn't notice his fingernails, all chewed up, but it's dark. They listen to the music. The smell of the ocean, the gentle rush of the waves, the berry scent of Sally's shampoo.
Now this is paradise, Sally says. I mean, what's better than listening to music like this with the waves crashing out here, the stars in the sky, and a glass of wine?
The wind kicks up, plays with Sally's hair. She has on a sweatshirt, but her legs are bare. He considers offering her a blanket, but better to stay low-key. One concerto ends, Sally making a comment about the fluidity of the cellist's bow strokes, and before long, she has drained her glass.
That should be enough.
I'm Sally, by the way.
Holden, he says. She looks over at him.
That's a nice name. Unique. Like the cat. Oh, wow.
She puts her hand on her chest, sits upright. A new concerto. The cellist hits a climax early on, joined by other strings and some percussion.
I think something.
Sally lets out a low moan. He lifts his face to the sky, feels the gentle breeze.
I think it's time, he says.
I feel funny.
Sally lets out a moan. She tries to push herself up, but it's like the signals aren't reaching her limbs. She can't make her arms or legs work.
I finally get it,
he says, warmth spreading through him like a cup of hot cocoa.
There is a monster inside me. It can sleep for days, for months, but it will never go away.
Help. Help me.
Sally turns to him, her face tight with fear, her eyes searching his. He watches her face closely, the trembling lips, the wide eyes, the flaring nostrils. Pure horror. So pure. So real. She's losing her motor functions. She can't move her arms or legs anymore. She'll have trouble speaking, too. But she can still breathe.
Please.
Just a whisper now. Her arms give out and she falls prone on the blanket, the music dropping to a low point. Lots of highs and lows with this cello music, like a roller coaster. Like his stomach feels sometimes. Her lips are quivering and her eyes move frantically about. That's going to be the extent of her physical movement until the drug wears off. By then, it will be too late. He puts himself over her, lowers his face to hers.
Don't be afraid,
he whispers, his voice feeling stronger now.
You can't move, but you'll still feel.
Her trembling lips try to form a word.
You'll feel everything,
he says. Chapter 54. He rests his cheek against the concrete wall, sniffing the faint smell of bleach. The chamber is all concrete, floor, walls, ceiling. The acoustics are poor and the lighting is dim. There is no electricity here and zero sunlight. So he makes do with three kerosene lanterns he has placed strategically. The effect is haunting, the light constantly changing as the small torches flicker inside their containers. Is this what it used to look like? He imagines it is. The walls were probably padded in some way back then. And of course, there were a cage and a long chain. But otherwise, this seems right.
Let me go, mister. I promise I won't say anything.
Sally, straining in a backward position, suspended in the air like a roasting pig over a fire. Her back arched painfully, her hands cuffed behind her back, her legs bound together likewise, then the hands and feet joined together by yet a third set of cuffs, attached to the chain that loops through a hook in the ceiling and runs to the crank attached to the wall. A crude pulley system. Not so crude, really. In fact, quite well constructed and in fair working order, despite decades of non-use. They don't make them like they used to. The metal pole built into the floor, protruding upward 5 feet with a steel tip, only 2 or 3 feet below Sally's straining, suspended body, lined up almost precisely with the lowest point of her body, near her belly button, her intestines, allowing gravity to do its work when the time comes. He turns the crank 1 full rotation. Sally's body free falls downward 1 foot or so, the chain shaking but holding. Her head bobs from the impact, but her body hardly moves, bound up as tightly as it is. She lets out a squeal, more animal than human. He walks over to her to measure things up, her terrified eyes in the flickering light, like something primeval. She is so beautiful. Fear is so raw, so pure. She tries to wiggle free. Admirable, but useless. She is basically hog-tied in mid-air,
and even if she were somehow able to free herself of the various steel handcuffs, to pull a stunt beyond even Houdini, it would only mean a quicker and more violent death on the spear. Maybe that's what she wants now. Maybe she's given up. Dee Dee and Annie didn't. They fought. The prostitute, Barbie, though, she gave up. That was the best. Watching her eyes surrender all hope, waiting, praying for the end to come. He touches Sally's face, and she snaps her head away violently. That wasn't very nice.
Let me down from here, mister, please. I have money.
He can't let her go. He realizes that now. I can no longer resist it, any more than I can resist my very existence. Shaken, he returns to the wall and grabs hold of the crank. There is a monster inside me. It can sleep for days, for months. He turns the crank another full rotation. But it will never go away. It will feast on me, prey on me, until the day I die.
Book 5, Bridgehampton, 2012. Chapter 55. You shouldn't be doing this, I say as I walk along the side of the road down Ocean Drive toward the Atlantic, the wind calm and the sun beating down on us. Roger that, says Ricketts, my rookie companion. I'm a dead ender, I tell her. You know what that is? I think so. Your career's hit a wall? Roger that. Without realizing it, I find that my stride has slowed as I near the end of the road, as I approach Seven Ocean Drive. Point being, I've got nothing to lose, I explain. Chief's gonna stick me in one dead end after another until I quit. So I figure I might as well solve a crime or two in my free time. But you, Ricketts, you've got a whole career ahead of you. Ricketts is wearing a Red Sox t-shirt with running shorts and Nikes. She is the same build as me, lean and hard, but she gets it from genetics, not from working out like I do. Dad always said I had an attitude problem. The Red Sox shirt being one example, I note. I feel my heartbeat escalate, a banging drum against my chest. My breathing tightens up as well. Are you okay, Murphy? I stop and take a breath. Something about this damn house. Every time I get close to it. Like my nightmares, only while awake. Put claustrophobia and panic in a bowl and stir for 2 minutes. I'm fine. Let's go. I trudge forward on shaky legs, not eager to share my sob story of scary dreams and panic attacks with the rookie. Why are we going to the house? She asks me. A welcome question, allowing me to focus on the case and not on this feeling overcoming me. The hooker, Brittany Halstead, I say. He stuck a corkscrew so far inside her, it almost came out the other side. Sally Feister, that backpacker? He used some kind of spear and drove it almost all the way through her midsection, right? And somehow managed to drain all the blood out of her body, Ricketts says. By the time they found her on an East Hampton beach, she was white as a bedsheet. Right. And last year, the other prostitute, Bonnie Stamos, impaled on a tree stump. And then my Uncle Lang. I can't bring myself to finish the sentence, but she gets it. The killer drove a heated poker through Lang's kidney and into the kitchen floor. He likes to do more than just cut them, says Ricketts. He likes to stick it in deep. You think maybe this is a sexual thing with him? We stop at the grand wrought iron gates of Seven Ocean Drive. All at once, it's like the temperature has been turned up. The loss of breath, the pressure on my chest. I close my eyes and take a deep breath. Jesus, Murphy, are you having a heart attack or something? Something. I shake it off, slide between the gates, and look back at her through the bars. Nobody invited us here, I say. And we're cops. Right, she says. As in, we're not supposed to do this. Roger that. You can turn back now, Ricketts. I could. You should turn back now. I probably should. She slips through the small space between the gates, joining me on the other side. But I'm not. I'm going where you're going. Tell me why we're at the murder house. I nod, take another breath, and move up the driveway until it curves off toward the carriage house up the hill. At that point, I take the stone path that, after a healthy hike, will lead to the front door of this grandiose monstrosity of a house. "This place always gives me the creeps," says Ricketts. "It's like a multi-headed monster. All the different color limestone, the different roof lines, all those gargoyles and ornamental spears pointed up at the sky. Yeah, it's a real fun place." I divert from the stone path onto the enormous expanse of grass before the slope upward toward the mansion. I stop at the stone fountain with the monument bearing the family crest and inscription. "This is why we're here," I say. "Because of a fountain?" I point at the small stone tablet, the crest featuring the bird with the hooked beak and long tail feather, the circle of tiny daggers surrounding it. "That," I say. "That fucking bird." She doesn't get the context. She doesn't know that this miserable little winged creature has been haunting my dreams. "Looks like an ordinary bird," she says, moving closer. "An ugly one, but it looks harmless. Why would you have a little bird like this on your family crest? You'd think it would be a falcon or an eagle or some scary majestic bird." I've spent the last 2 days researching that animal, trying to identify it among hundreds of species of birds in a catalog. When I matched it up, some things started to make more sense. "It's a shrike," I say. "A small bird, yes. No large talons, no great wingspan. Not what you'd think of as a bird of prey. You're right. It looks harmless. But guess how it kills its food?" Ricketts looks upward, thinking, "I'm gonna use my powers of deductive reasoning and say it spears them somehow." "Close," I say. "It impales them." She draws back. "Really?" "Really. It scoops up insects, rodents, whatever, and carries them to the nearest sharp point, a thorn, the spikes of a barbed wire fence, whatever it can find, and shish kebabs them. Then it tears at them with that hooked beak." Ricketts slowly nods. "Most of our victims suffered some version of impalement." I wag my finger at that monument, the crest and the shrike. This isn't a coincidence. Our psychopath has a real hard-on for this family, maybe for this house, I say. "So I want you to find out everything you can about Seven Ocean Drive. And this note under the crest. Cecilia, oh Cecilia, life was death disguised. Find out what that means too." "I will," she says, not hiding her excitement. "Right away." "Great. Now it's time for you to go home, Ricketts." "Why? What are you gonna do?" I nod toward the house. "I'm going inside." "I'll come with you." "No," I shake my head. "Walking into the yard is one thing. Breaking into the house is another. I don't want to be responsible for you."
"I'll take my chances."
"Get lost. That's an order," I say. "Besides, you have a lot of work to do." Chapter 56. I hold my breath and push open the front door. When I walk in, I immediately feel a weight pressing down on me, my movements slowing, an impossible wave of heat spreading through me. "Fight through it. You have work to do, so do it." I stagger forward, feeling disoriented, lightheaded, as if drugged. So hot, like a fireplace inside my chest. The dramatic Old Testament frescoes on the ceiling, the gold-framed portraits of men in formal 18th century dress mocking me. Feeling my oxygen depleting, taking shallow breaths and keeping my chin up, my wits about me, as the childish cackling and taunting echo through my ears.
"Please, don't make me go there. Please don't do this. I want to go home."
The anteroom angling sideways, the lighting in front of me spotty. But I'm not turning back. There's got to be something here, and I'm gonna find it. Into the foyer, the staircase to the second floor before me, a parlor of some kind to my right, antique furniture and custom molding and chandeliers, an ornate fireplace, I turn toward the parlor but can't move toward it, as if a gravitational pull is drawing me in the opposite direction. And suddenly I'm staggering to my left instead, nearly losing my balance. The dining room. Elaborate carvings on the walls, tall windows with fancy trim, a chandelier hanging over a pentagonal oak table with high-backed chairs. I reach for one of the chairs and grip it as if holding on for my life. I can't do this, I whisper, the childish taunt still banging between my ears, drowning out even my own voice. I need to be here, but I can't be here. I push myself off the chair and start across the dining room, headed toward what must be the kitchen. My nerves scattered about, my vision unfocused, oxygen coming as if I'm taking breaths through a straw. I draw my sidearm for no reason that makes sense. Get out of here. Stay and investigate. My legs finally give out and I fall to my knees as if in prayer. Let me go. Don't make me do this. Someone please help me. Let me out of here. I put my hand on the windowsill for support, push myself up with my free hand, my Glock held forward with the other hand, trembling. Then I look down. On the windowsill, jagged letters carved into the wood. D.P. and A.C. Black spots before my eyes, my body turning, my legs like gelatin, moving in slow motion, like my feet are wading through thick sand. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Let me out of here. Bam, bam, bam. Let me out of here. Bam, bam, bam. The ornate patterned tile floor, then my hand on the door, pushing it, pushing it. Why won't it? Then turning the handle and pulling. Fresh air on my face. Sunlight. I take a deep, greedy breath of fresh air and slam the door behind me. I fall to a knee on the porch and gather myself. I don't know what just happened, why it always happens, why I'm having these dreams, why it all seems to be getting worse. And suddenly tears are falling off my cheeks. My body is trembling uncontrollably, my breath seizing, and I don't understand any of this. I don't know why something inside me seems to be breaking, and I don't know how to stop it. I only know one thing I didn't know before. They were here, I say to nobody. Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church were in this house. Chapter 57. The motorcycle takes a left off the turnpike onto the gravel drive, and I keep driving north. But the first chance I get, I turn left into a side street, do a quick U-turn, and head south. I pull into the parking lot a few minutes later, my car bouncing over the uneven gravel. When I push the door open and walk into Tasty's, Noah Walker is at a corner table, just getting started on a beer. He's halfway to raising the bottle to his lips when he sees me. I see the hunky, clean-cut owner, Justin Rivers, behind the counter. He gives me a soldier's salute, kind of dorky. He's a looker, but sort of a nerd. And I nod back.
If it isn't Bridgehampton's finest, Noah says, taking a swig as I approach.
He wears the grunge look well. T-shirt, cargo shorts, and sandals. Since his hair was cut tight while he was at Sing Sing, he looks less like Matthew McConaughey and more like a musclehead weightlifter. A thick vein runs along his rippled biceps as he lowers the beer bottle to the table. Not that I'm looking at his rippled biceps. I stand near his table in the near-empty shack of a restaurant, hands on my hips. You know something, Walker? I can't decide if you're the smartest criminal I've ever met or a guy with a lot of really bad luck. He sets down the bottle and finishes his swallow.
Good evening to you too, detective.
I look around the place. Only two other customers this time of night, past the dinner rush, and they're at the other end of the shack. I drop two photographs on the table next to his beer. You know those women? Noah looks at the photos casually at first, then with what looks to me like a glint of recognition in his eyes, and he lifts the photos, peering at them.
His eyes drift off them like he's recalling something. After a long moment, he looks at me. Why? It's a simple question, Noah. If you have nothing to hide, why shouldn't matter? They look familiar, but I don't know why. He drops the photos back on the table. Okay. You've worked for years at Seven Ocean Drive, I say. He shakes his head, bemused. That house again? Yeah, I think everyone in the world knows by now that I did work on that house. Those two girls, I say, were staying in that house in 2007. They went missing afterward. They were Yale undergrads who came to the Hamptons and were never seen again. Nobody was even looking for them in Bridgehampton, and definitely not in that house. But now we know they were there. So that's two couples who stayed in that house. Two couples dead. So now you're accusing me of that, too? He gets up from his chair, kicking it back violently. You know something, detective? I can't figure you out either. First, you ruin my life by lying on the witness stand and sending me to prison. Then you tell the judge I was framed, and I start to think you might be a human being. And now you're back accusing me of everything that's ever happened in this town. I mean, I can't even have dinner. I narrow my eyes, appraising him. The same read as always. I'm not getting killer from his vibe. I'm not sure what I'm getting. He keeps his eyes on me, challenging me, a twinkle of a dare in his eyes, the smell of his sweat coming off him. There's a lot of coincidences involving you, Noah. I back away from the table. But for now, I'll leave you to your dinner. The other diners in the restaurant, getting a good eyeful, return to their meals as I pass them. I wave to Justin on my way out. Hey, Noah says as I'm ready to push through the door. I turn, and he's walking up to me. He looks me over, works his unshaven jaw, heat across my chest. Let me ask you some, he says. You're an experienced cop, right? You've stared down all sorts of bad people, cold-blooded killers. I've seen my share. Do I really seem like a killer to you? He opens his arms as if to give me a clear view. The thick scarring on his palms from the crucifixion at Sing Sing. That's been my problem all along. Even when certain evidence points to him, when the facts line up against him, every time I look him in the eye, I just don't see it. There is anger behind his eyes, and he's lived rough, no doubt. But is there rage? The capacity for horrific sadism? That mental switch that flips on and allows him to turn into a monster? I tell him the truth. I say, I'm not sure. Chapter 58. Midnight. The temperature fallen to the low 50s, the wind coming hard off the ocean, less than a mile to the south, carrying some hint of the rain that just stopped an hour ago, with me unprepared in my short sleeves. I left the bar in a fog, not drunk exactly, not on alcohol at least. My emotions swirling, my thoughts consumed by the murders, by Uncle Lang, by my shipwreck of a life. And somehow, instead of driving home, I found myself at the cemetery on Main Street. The lighting from the street is dim, casting the cemetery in almost complete darkness. I can't even read the tombstone, but I know it, of course, by heart. Langdon Travis James, it reads. He kept us safe. That's what he told Chloe he wanted said about him when it was all over, that he devoted his life to protecting people. And he did. Sure, he cut some corners with the Ocean Drive murders, but he thought Noah was his guy. He thought he was framing a killer whom he otherwise couldn't catch. Wrong methods, but right reasons. And I, of all people, exposed him. I didn't have a choice. I hope he knows that. Aunt Chloe promised me that he does, wherever he is now. Aunt Chloe, whose blank tombstone rests next to Lang's. He bought these tombstones early in their marriage, Chloe said, so they'd be together forever. He was broken when she left him. She surely had her reasons, but he lost the love of his life. He was never the same person again. My mother was never the same after my father and Ryan died in that car accident either. Losing your soulmate by death or divorce
Is it better than never having one in the first place? Better to have loved and lost, as they say, than never to have loved at all? I drop to my haunches, suddenly exhausted. Chloe's right. I have to leave this place. It's doing something to me. But that means I'll have to give up being a cop. Nobody will give me another chance. The job's my love, probably the only one I'll ever have. But I'll have to leave. I don't think I can survive many more of these night terrors, these panic attacks or whatever they are. But first things first. I'm not leaving, I say to Lang Stone, until I figure out who killed you. The winds die down. A noise. A shuffling movement. I get to my feet and spin around. I look south into darkness, my eyes not fully adjusted. A beam of light 20 yards away, a small yellow circle on the ground. I draw my sidearm. Who's there? I call out. The light swings in my direction until it passes across my face, then returning to me, blinding me. Town police! I call out, shutting my eyes. The light on my face disappears. I open my eyes, unable to see much of anything from the overload to my retinas. I squint and drop low. Identify yourself, I yell. I hear something, feet adjusting in wet grass. Think maybe I see a figure moving. The flashlight beam has disappeared, nothing but spotty darkness. I break into a run, the gun at my side, my eyes still off kilter after the blinding light, dodging tombstones as best I can. As I race farther south, some faint light off the side street helps me navigate. The figure up ahead in a full-out sprint. Stop! Town police! I pick up my pace, feeling like I'm closing the gap, a faint mist hitting my face, but it's not far from the street, and then the woods. Plenty of places to hide. I'm running full speed, but I'm running out of time. I fire around into the earth. The gunshots echo piercing, and the sloshing sound of feet running on wet grass suddenly stops. Don't move! Town police! I shuffle forward, both hands on the gun trained ahead of me, though I can't really make out the figure yet. Hands out where I can see them! I order, as if I could possibly see them. As I get closer and my eyes readjust, I make him. He's turned to face me. His arms are extended upward. A mousy face, hair jutting out from beneath a baseball cap, flip backward. Who are you? I ask. But I think I know the answer. Who are you? He says. Detective Murphy, STPD. Tell me who you are and don't move. Aiden Willis. I shuffle toward him, closing the gap, less than 10 yards away. The wind picks a lousy time to kick back up, carrying mist and some stray leaves. You in the habit of running from cops, Aiden?
I didn't know you were a cop.
I announced myself. Moving closer still, gun still held high, adrenaline still pumping.
So? How do I know it's true?
A fair point, I guess. This time of night, in a cemetery? Where's that flashlight? I ask.
In my hand?
Shine it under your chin, I say. And move slowly, Aiden. Don't make a cop with a gun nervous. He complies. The light goes on, and there he is, illuminated by a haunting ghost story around the campfire light under his face. Those raccoon eyes that constantly flitter about. What are you doing here, Aiden? Moving closer, under 5 yards now.
What are you doing here?
Hey, pal, you want to stop asking me the same question I ask you?
I work here.
True enough, that. Isaac told me he did maintenance here. You're working at midnight, are you?
It rained. We got an open site for burial tomorrow. Sometimes the rain messes it up. I'm just checking.
Who's getting buried?
How should I know?
I feel my adrenaline decelerating. You scared the shit out of me, I say.
You scared the shit out of me.
What's with this guy repeating everything I say? But I have no basis to detain him. And now that my heart has stopped racing, and the wind's finding its way under my shirt and licking my sweat-covered face and neck, I'm reminded how freaking cold it is out here.
I remember you now,
he mumbles. Or at least that's what I think he said.
What?
Did he say he remembers me? He double blinks.
Can I go now?
I let out a breath. Yeah. The light goes off under Aiden's face, bathing him in darkness again. Chapter 59.
Let me out!
Bam, bam, bam.
Let me out!
Bam, bam, bam.
I can't see. Can't breathe. Darkness, then penetrating light from above. A shadow blocking it. A face coming into focus, backlit by blinding yellow. A boy. Long hair. A hand. Don't touch me. Please, don't touch.
I lurch forward in bed, sucking in air. My heartbeat rattling. The same nightmare, but different. Closed in. Dark. Let me out. Suffocating. But a boy. This time, a boy. I squeeze my eyes shut and try to recreate it, to make out a face, but it's like trying to grasp vapor in your hand. You can't pull back a dream from the netherworld of the subconscious. It comes when it wants to, and it vanishes at will. I climb out from under the covers, wipe thick sweat off my forehead, splash cold water on my face in the bathroom. 4:45. Slept for 4 hours. I throw on a shirt and shorts, lace up my New Balance shoes, and hit the pavement for 10 miles. The Hamptons, at their most charming at sunrise, the tranquil bays and deserted beaches and open roads, the smell of recent rain. I run over sand and grass and asphalt, working out the kinks, exercising the night demons. Later, I'm in my car, heading toward the school, my thrilling assignment. I dial information on my cell phone and get the number for the church.
Presbyterian Church,
an elderly woman's cheery voice. Hi, I say. I was wondering if you could tell me if there's a burial today.
Today? Well, hold on, sweetie.
Muffled conversation in the background.
Today? No, ma'am. We don't have any burials scheduled for the rest of this week. What's the name of the deceased?
No burials today. Aiden Willis lied to me.
I must have the wrong cemetery. My apologies. Thank you very much.
Why would Aiden lie about his reason for being at the cemetery last night? My cell phone buzzes in my hand. It's from the substation.
Murphy, I say. Detective, it's Margaret at the substation. Chief Marks wants to see you.
I'm on my way to my assignment, I say.
He said right now.
I blow out air. He didn't say it very nicely either, she adds in a quieter voice. Chapter 60. I turn my car around and drive to the substation. What assignment is Chief Marks going to give me now? School crossing guard? By the time I enter his office, I've worked up a little attitude. How much worse can it get for me here? Isaac takes his time reading a report, making me wait, purposeful, a show of authority, and starts talking to me without looking up.
Detective Murphy, he says. Why are you asking people at the school about the Halloween BB gun shooting from 17 years ago?
I should have seen this coming. I'm trying to figure out more about Noah Walker, I say. Who he hung around with, who helped him shoot all those kids.
Helped him shoot those kids?
The chief drops his report.
Nobody helped Walker shoot those kids. He did it all by himself.
I shake my head. There was a second shooter.
No. There wasn't. I was there. I was the same age as Noah. Same school.
I'm well aware of that fact, Isaac.
The angles of the shots fired, I say. And why was Noah just sitting on a bench by the school, waiting to get caught?
Are you kidding me?
Because he's a psychopath, Murphy. The kind that could slaughter a family and then sit next to you on a bus and engage in polite conversation.
He had no remorse, no guilt. No sense that he'd even done anything wrong. He leans forward in his chair. And why are we even having this conversation?
Why are you looking into this? because if Noah didn't kill those people at Seven Ocean Drive or my uncle, then someone sure made it look like he did. Someone set him up. And someone set him up 17 years ago. The school shooting, too. You're actually trying to tie those two things together? I shrug. Call it a hunch. But yeah, this is a really small town. It's possible. Look, I'm doing the assignment you gave me. I'm doing this other stuff on my free time. I don't want you doing it on any time, he says. No more questions about a second shooter. No more investigations into Seven Ocean Drive or your uncle. Can I be any clearer? No, you're very clear, Chief, I reply. In fact, I'd like to compliment you on how clear you're being, Chief. May I be excused, Chief? Isaac stares me down, his tongue rolling inside his cheek. He gets out of his seat and comes around the desk. I stand too, so we're face to face. Let's go off the record, he says. Let's. Nothing leaves this room. Agreed. What is this fascination with Noah Walker? I don't have a You want to fuck him, don't you? I draw back. What did you just say? Isaac throws up a hand in disgust. Always the same with that guy. A juvenile fucking delinquent since the day I met him, but every girl in school fantasized about him. The kid's never been anything but bad. Believe me, I know him a lot better than you, Murphy. Don't be fooled by the movie star good looks. That guy's nothing but a bad seed. For a moment, I'm speechless. Isaac's chest is heaving, his cheeks crimson. It's like we're replaying middle school here. Did he steal your girlfriend or something, Isaac? His eyes flare. He drives a finger into my chest. Noah Walker killed those people at Seven Ocean Drive, and Noah Walker killed your uncle. Noah Walker shot up that school all by himself. You will stop trying to prove otherwise. You will stop right now, or I'm pulling your badge. I hold my breath, willing myself to calm down. You're pathetic, I say. I mean, since we're off the record. He nods, grins at me. Coffee breath and stained teeth. You think you're untouchable, but you're not. I'm gonna run you out of here sooner or later. Yeah? Good. I turn and head for the door. Oh, and Murphy, since we're off the record. He takes a breath and composes himself. I thought your uncle was a worthless prick.
Chapter 61. The man who thinks of himself as Holden is getting restless. No, it's not summer yet, but this March has been one of the warmest on record. Is that close enough? Maybe. For right now, he'll enjoy the sights and sounds at Tasty's. So many people to choose from, men and women both. He'll have to make a list and plan this out. He's good at planning them. Hell, look at last summer. The summer of 2011, 4 victims. In one summer, he doubled what he'd done up until then. Zach and Melanie, that hooker named Bonnie, and the good old police chief. The police chief. And is he in prison? Nope, he sure isn't. How's that for smart? You kill the chief of police and nobody can lay a glove on you. His eyes wander beyond the crowded restaurant to the window, where he recognizes someone getting out of a car in the parking lot. Detective Jenna Murphy, the sexy redhead detective, blue jacket over a white blouse, tight-fitting jeans, low heels. She thinks she's smart. She thinks she's smarter than everyone. But she's not that smart. If she's so smart, why doesn't she remember me from all those years ago? It might be fun to remind her one of these days.
Chapter 62. Officer Ricketts and I are out of luck when we enter Tasty's for lunch. No open tables. We take seats at the counter with its view of the kitchen, where cooks in aprons and white hats are chopping and broiling and frying, reading orders off slips of paper clipped above them. The smells of garlic and tomato sauce and fried food fill the air. Aiden Willis is sitting alone at a middle table. Always that cap turned backward, the straw-like hair jutting out, those beady, meandering eyes. He's reading something while he eats fried fish out of a paper tray. Time will come. I'll ask him how that burial went yesterday, to see if he'll keep lying about it. But I don't want to tip my hand yet. We both order scallops. Ricketts orders one of those iced tea drinks served in those giant, colorful cans. Ice water for me. Over my shoulder, I see Chief Isaac Marks wearing a bib and dipping lobster into butter sauce. Another table for one. He must see me, but after our words yesterday, there isn't much left to say. Careful, I tell Ricketts. Chief's sitting over there. Let's not be too obvious. She leans into me. How about I just talk quietly then? I won't pull out my notes. She taps her head. It's all up here anyway. It's pretty loud in here, so that would probably work. Give me the Reader's Digest, I say. She takes a deep breath. A waiter serves us our drinks, mine in a plastic cup. The Reader's Digest, she says, is creepy. A ripple of boisterous laughter behind us. I turn back and see a group of guys, construction workers, a testosterone fest, in the corner. One of them, Noah Walker. T-shirt stretched tight over his chest, dirty jeans, work boots. I feel my temperature rise and pull my shirt off my suddenly sticky chest. Something about that guy. I can't deny it. Can't understand it either. I have my back to the crowd, but when I'm turned toward Ricketts, I have a good sight line to both Noah and Aiden Willis. Isaac is behind me. Three men, all about the same age, all at Bridgehampton School. Ricketts says, the house at Seven Ocean Drive was built by a Dutch settler named Winston Dahlquist in the late 1700s. He had like this massive potato farm on Long Island and was crazy rich. He had a wife, Cecilia, and one son. Cecilia, oh Cecilia, life was death disguised. Cecilia died in 1813. They said she jumped out of her bedroom window. She landed on the spiked fence. She landed on it? Oh yeah, they found her impaled on the fence, 20 feet off the ground. Her body was almost cut in half. But the author of the book I read on this, she had someone diagram everything, the angles, the distances. She concluded that if Cecilia had jumped from her bedroom, she would have landed several yards short of the fence. So the wife was pushed. Ricketts nods. Tell me about the son, I say. His name was Holden, Holden Dahlquist. Noah's eyes break away from his conversation and catch mine. He does a double take. Then he fixes on me, his expression easing, his eyes narrowing. Holden was basically insane, she says. Erratic, violent, couldn't be in school. The author of the book thinks Holden's the one who killed Cecilia. He would have been 17 at the time. He killed his mother. I nod along, casually, like she's telling me about a new pair of heels she bought. Apparently, after Cecilia died, Winston was never the same. As time went on, Winston started going batty too. He wrote in a letter, I remember this, he wrote, I hesitate to declare what is more alarming, the extent to which my son is beginning to resemble a wild animal, or the extent to which I am beginning to resemble him. Aiden Willis stands up and fishes in his pocket for money, drops it on the table. Under his arm is a paperback, Steinbeck, of Mice and Men. A little deeper reading than I might have expected from our Aiden. Apparently, after Cecilia's death, a string of murders and disappearances began. Ricketts continues. Over 24 people died over the next 20 years. I turn back to Ricketts. Tell me about the victims. They were hookers or immigrants. They'd go missing in the summer, and then they'd be found dead with some kind of hole in their body. Usually a through and through. Impaled, I say, my heartbeat responding. Yeah, always some kind of spear or cutting instrument. And sometimes with all the blood drained out of their bodies. Jesus, I draw back. And they never put this on Winston? Or his kid, Holden? My eye catches Aiden Willis, stuffing his hands in his pockets, checking me out with a sidelong glance on his way out, the paperback still tucked under his arm. Then I look back at Noah, who's watching me while he drinks a bottle of beer, still with his friends at the table. Then Noah's expression changes, goes cold, hard, and his eyes move away from mine to Isaac, approaching him, the entire table freezing up. Isaac, with that cop bravado, saying something to Noah that elicits a frown. And I see something in Noah's eyes that makes me think there's going to be violence between them. But then Isaac moves along, heading toward the exit, catching my eye as well, smirking at me. They never charged either Winston or Holden, says Ricketts. Legend has it, Winston had the local constable in his pocket. He was one of the wealthiest people on Long Island. I watch Isaac leave and think over what Ricketts has told me. He chose prostitutes and immigrants, I say. Drifters. People who wouldn't be missed. Yeah, there's a saying attributed to Winston. I think I have this right. A peasant, any peasant will do. And better still, a stranger. Whosoever shall not be missed is welcome in my chamber. Our scallops arrive, with a delicious, buttery aroma, but I've lost my appetite. Sounds like a fun family, I say. Oh, but it gets better, Ricketts says, trying to keep her voice down. Every generation left a single son, each of them named Holden. Holden Jr., Holden the Third, etc., all the way to Holden the Sixth. All of them suffering some mental illness. Most of them suspected of violence. One of them killed his wife. Several committed suicide. Where's the most recent Holden? I ask. Ricketts spears a scallop with her fork. In the ground, she says. The last Holden died almost 20 years ago, without any children. Chapter 63. I check my sidearm for ammunition and holster it. My head is buzzing after spending hours poring over a copy of the book that Ricketts used for her research. Winston's Heirs, A Haunted House in the Hamptons, chronicling the Dahlquists from the time when Winston came to Long Island in the late 1700s until recent years. The many generations of Holdens. The original Holden, who these days would have been in an institution for the criminally insane, who may have murdered as many as 24 women. Holden Jr., who had 3 kids, of whom only one survived, the only boy. Holden III, who decapitated his wife on their 5th anniversary before jumping out of the same bedroom window from which Cecilia fell. Holden IV, who went through 4 wives and a lot of booze before hanging himself at age 52. Holden V, who married and divorced 3 times and overdosed on a combination of amphetamines and alcohol, just days after 4 vacationers were stabbed to death on the beach not 50 yards from his house at 7 Ocean Drive. And Holden VI, described by his mother as a simpleton with violent tendencies and the empathy of a rattlesnake, but other than that, a dear boy. Known for his philanthropy publicly, but suspected of multiple rapes and assaults, none of which ever stuck. Holden was found dead in his bedroom in 1994. He slashed his own throat and tossed the knife out the window before dying, thus ending the ignominious reign of the Dahlquist clan. My sidearm in place, I leave the house, a chill in the midnight air. I start up my car and put it into gear. The roads are all but empty at this hour, in late March, before the summer vacationers have begun to arrive. A gray pall hangs over the lonely streets. I kill the headlights as I approach and let my foot off the gas. I pull my car over on Main Street and kill the engine. I'll walk the rest of the way. 1 hand on my sidearm, the other clutching my mag light. I approach the cemetery from the west. The air is thick, promising rain, but none has yet fallen. As I get closer, the street lighting dims considerably, leaving the cemetery in sleepy black. This time, I'm more prepared. A sweater instead of short sleeves, running shoes, not flats, a flashlight. I pass through the gate quietly and drop down low in the grass among the tombstones. It may take a while, if it happens at all. But just to be sure, I'm not signaling my presence. The wind kicks up off the ocean, making me wish I'd worn a second layer. Standing still, crouch down. It's not easy to stay warm. My eyes begin to adjust to the darkness, but the effect isn't helpful. It's still too dark to see much of anything. But now the darkness is filled with dancing shadows and fleeting movements. Keep it together, Murphy. The sleep deprivation doesn't help. My eyes feel heavy these days, my movements lumbering, my brain fueled by adrenaline, but unfocused, sloppy. A noise. Something soft, but persistent. At first, I think it's wind rustling through the trees, but it stays consistent when the breeze ebbs, grows stronger as it draws closer. Footfalls. Someone walking over the soft earth, heading toward the cemetery. But no flashlight beam, nothing illuminating his path. I steel myself, but don't dare move. I can't see anything in the blackness, but the sound is unmistakable now. Someone walking into the cemetery. He's walking in pitch dark without the aid of a flashlight and without hesitation. He knows exactly where he's going. Knows it by heart. And then the footsteps stop. I look up, but can't see anything. Close enough for me to hear. Too far away for me to see. Maybe a hood. A sweatshirt with a hood. A beam of light pops on, startling me. I almost fall backward in my crouch. I try to gauge his location from the flashlight beam. But then the light disappears almost as quickly as it appeared. Darkness again. And silence. What is... A new sound. Spray of some kind. A thin stream of liquid slapping against stone. Sounds like... No, I decide. Couldn't be. Chapter 64. I stay fixed in my position until the sound stops. Then the footsteps begin again, but now moving away from me. He's leaving the cemetery, same way he came, disappearing into the void of black. Should I accost him? I'm assuming it's Aiden Willis, as before, but I can't see shit out here. And if I confront him, I might be giving up an advantage. No. Better I let him leave and try to figure out what he does here at night. I wait until I can't hear him anymore, then wait another 10 minutes for good measure. I keep my eyes focused on where I saw that momentary flashlight beam, trying to use it as a beacon to guide me in the pitch dark. Once I'm ready to move, I shine my maglight at that destination point and start walking toward it. It's not perfect, but it should get me where I'm going, especially if that sound was what I think it was. Something big up ahead, something tall. The cemetery has all kinds of tombstones, large and elaborate, small and simple, many variations in between. This one is of the big and fancy variety. I run the light over the monument until I hit the name. Dahlquist. A large stone monument bearing that same family crest with the bird, the shrike. The whole plot surrounded by an iron bar, no more than 3 feet off the ground, supported by small stone pillars. My heart skips a beat. I move closer, sweep the beam of light around. 3 tombstones at the monument's base. Winston, Cecilia, Holden. The first Dahlquists. Then, just below them, 5 more tombstones. Presumably for the successive generations of Dahlquists. All males named Holden. I shine my light over each Holden tombstone. The earliest ones in not nearly as good shape as the more recent ones. Finally, I hit the last generation. Holden the 6th, buried here since 1994. There it is. I bend down to get a closer look at the tombstone. Fresh liquid splattered all over it. I don't dare taste it, but I lower my face close enough to confirm with my nose what I thought I heard with my ears. Urine. Whoever crept into the cemetery just took a piss all over Holden the 6th's grave. Good thing I looked up Aiden's address. Maybe it's time to pay him a visit. Chapter 65. I kill the headlights so Aiden won't see my car approaching his house. But he might hear it bouncing over the bumpy, unforgiving roads just north of Main Street. His house is obscured by trees until I reach his driveway. I pass it and pull the car over on the sloping shoulder of the road. Only a quarter mile away, last summer, the prostitute Bonnie Stamos was found impaled on that tree stump. The house is dark as I walk up the driveway. It's a dilapidated, shingled ranch that almost sags at its sides. A beater Chevy parked in the driveway. I step up onto a cracked concrete porch and can't find a doorbell. I open the screen door, which is on the verge of falling off, and bang my fist on the door. "Open up, Aiden! Town police!" Nothing at first. I bang again, announce my office once more. Nothing. He couldn't have beaten me here by much. 15 minutes tops. No way he's asleep. It was Aiden I saw, wasn't it? "Open up, Aiden!" I pound on the door until my fist hurts. I check my watch. 12:30. Either he's not home or he's ignoring me. Either way, I'm out of luck. It's not like I can kick in the door. I don't have probable cause or anything close to it. But nothing says I can't check the back of the house. No outdoor lighting on the house. The property surrounded by trees that block any neighboring light.